is sort of review history right here. Of course, Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen felt that quantum mechanics was incomplete. The crux of the problem is that classical mechanics gives statistical predictions, or gives deterministic predictions. Quantum mechanics gives statistical predictions or probabilities. The big step forward came in 1964. There was all this, these philosophical discussions for 30 years and no experiments or possibilities of experiments until John Bell in 1964 proved Bell's theorem, in which he assumed locality, completion, and positive probabilities, and proved first that the statistical predictions of any local theory that completes quantum mechanics has to satisfy an inequality. And then the crucial thing is that the statistical predictions of quantum mechanics can violate inequalities. And the point is that when you go in the laboratory, it's the statistical results that we measure. And so, so for the first time, a definitive laboratory experiment is possible. And the Clauser, Holt, Horn, Gemini paper is the one that first took Bell's theorem and put it into an experimentally feasible frame. The initial experiments, of course, you all know Clauser's experiment at Berkeley, which violated the Bell inequality and satisfied the quantum mechanical predictions. And in 1974, Holt and Pipkin did the experiment at Harvard and got in the result that satisfied the Bell inequality and disagreed with quantum mechanics. And in fact, actually, I became an assistant professor in 1969 at Texas A&M University and learned about the Clauser, Holt, Horn, Gemini paper in the fall of 1969 and immediately came up with my plan for an experiment. And I tried to get funding for it, of course, and attitudes were such that was out of the question at the time. I got horrible reviews from NSF, and so I gave up on it. And then the Harvard experiment came out, and in the meantime, I had talked to several people, and among them was Wigner. Wigner was very helpful to me in getting money for the experiment, which I did in '76. And we got agreement with quantum mechanics and clear violation of the Bell inequalities. And then the next experiments were in Paris, Alan Aspey's experiments, in which he actually added a couple new features, including two-channel detection from the polarizers and a version of testing locality. But all these experiments had loopholes. They required additional assumptions, and that, in fact, was the heart of the paper in 1969, was what you needed to do in order to make a feasible experiment with detectors, for example, that weren't 100% efficient and so forth. There have been more recent experiments. In every case, there's at least one loophole. The first experiments, in fact, actually the major contribution right here was Yan Huaxi's experiments, in which he used the two-photon down conversion to test a Bell inequality. And those were followed by Hong Wu and Mandel, who also did tests of Bell inequalities. This is Hirosha's experiment. They never actually did a test of Bell inequalities, but they did produce entangled pairs of atoms in a high Q cavity. Nice experiments by Jasan, in which he tested Bell inequality with entangled photons and a detector separation of over 10 kilometers. And let me make a comment. What happens is, it seems like there's lots of people that have done Bell inequality experiments now, and I don't intend this list to be comprehensive. In Innsbruck, they tested Bell inequality with entangled photons under strict Einstein locality conditions. In Boulder, Wineland's group tested an inequality with atoms, the first one with massive particles, and they had high 98% detection efficiency. But of course, what happens is they did many interactions, photon-atom interactions, to get a lot of photons coming out to detect their atom. So there was other things going on there. And then in 2003, in Austria, they tested Bell inequality with space and spin components of a single neutron, basically a neutron interferometer, in the space in the two arms and the spin. I wanted to make note of this point. The results of the Bell inequality experiments require any local hidden variable theory to be non-local, okay? Which is, in fact, in contrast to what I think Einstein was probably thinking at the time. And part of the reason I mention this is when I talk to people lots of times, there's a broad consensus that somehow Bell inequalities have proved that quantum mechanics is non-local, and it's not true. They do not require quantum mechanics to be non-local. But there's a misconception, at least among many of the people I have talked to. So what I want to focus on is Bohm's version of EPR. EPR originally, of course, was position and momentum. And Bohm put out a version with spin 1/2 particles that has a nice conceptual way of understanding things. And basically, the idea is the following. You start out with an ensemble of systems that have total spin angular momentum 0. Each one of these systems can be split up into two spin 1/2 particles. And those spin 1/2 particles go off in opposite directions. And you have Stern-Gerlach apparata on each side. And you measure, if, for example, you measure in the z direction here for this particle and you get spin up, then without in any way disturbing anything over here, you can predict with certainty that if you measure in the z direction over here, you'll get spin down. And in fact, Einstein's argument is that since without in any way disturbing anything over here, you know it spins down, there must be something real about the component of the spin down in the z direction. And even classically, that's not a problem. You know, that's like Bertelmann's socks, pink and green. You know, if you've only that's no problem. The problem comes is you can choose to measure, for example, in the x direction here, over here, measure in the x direction. And if you get out here, then you can predict with certainty that if you measure the x direction over here, you'll get in. And so Einstein says there must be something real about the component of the spin in the x direction. And of course, quantum mechanics doesn't permit us to have two components of the spin. And so in general, what happens, you can tilt these apparatus at various angles and measure correlations. And so that's Bohm's version of EPR. The spin singlet state looks like this, which you're all familiar with. What we're doing is an exact realization of that experiment. And basically, we start out with mercury 199 atoms in the form of a molecule, so it's a dimer, a homonuclear dimer. Total spin S equals 0. We split it up, and we get two mercury 199 atoms. Mercury 199 has nuclear spin 1/2, and J equals electron angular momentum is 0 because you have two outer electrons paired in the electronic configuration. And so the total spin of these things is nuclear spin 1/2, and they're in a singlet state, and we measure components of nuclear spin in various directions. Okay. Now, what happened? Actually, this is a slide that I had at the very end, and last night I changed my mind and decided to put it at the beginning. And so you can actually think about these things as I'm presenting the rest of it. But the point is, when you're testing a fundamental concept, it is vital to study over a wider range of parameters as possible. And in fact, actually, you already see there's been a lot of experiments done. We've already covered a wide range of those parameters, but not all of them, and not simultaneously. So both those things are important. This experiment with Mercury 199 will extend the parameter range. And first, the efficient detectors, we have observed detection efficiency of approximately 100% in the detection process. And so that's a real step forward. Of course, Alan was telling us basically 100% detection for his helium atoms this morning, too. Einstein locality can be strictly enforced in this experiment, and I'll describe that later. This is with spin 1/2 fermions rather than bosons. And this would be the first experiment involving an entangled pair of fermions. And so it's a really quantum object in spades. It involves massless particles rather than massless photons. Once again, that was what the Wineland experiment at NIST did too. But there's a number of features there that I want to emphasize. They're non-relativistic massive particles, so they obey the non-relativistic Schrödinger equation. It's in a regime very different from tests with photons. And actually, this is the same thing continued. They're inside the light cone rather than on it, because they have a velocity less than c and trace out a world line inside the light cone. So that's a significant difference. Photons have velocity c and are always on the light cone. Okay. Since Einstein locality plays a crucial role in the Bell inequality, the experimental tests inside the light cone are especially important in comparison to photon tests done on the light cone. That's true, actually. In fibers, it's going to be 50% slower. Since photons travel the velocity of light in any reference frame, they cannot be strictly localized. Okay. One of the nice things here is the entangled state in our initial experiments will exist for milliseconds before they get annihilated at the detectors. Even in Jassan's experiments with 10 kilometer spatial separation, the entangled state only existed for something like 30 microseconds. Is that right? I'm just wondering if I included index refraction when I calculated that right now. In our case, the two mercury atoms travel slow compared to C, and the entangled state must continue to exist at large spatial separations for milliseconds, which is a long time on these scales. And then this is a really cute aspect of it, is something that we've been looking at. The possibility exists here to actually store the two components of the entangled state so you could actually move them around and then check it out later. In other words, and the idea is you store them in a frozen neon matrix. Once you've made these, once you have the mercury atom pair, you can freeze it in a frozen neon matrix. And this is something that chemists have done for a long time. In fact, actually, in this case, we've got a nuclear spin, so it's really well shielded from everything. Can't find any information or any data to really tell me how well that will be preserved. But I think, in fact, actually, the major thing that will mess anything up is stray magnetic fields. But even in that case, since it's a nuclear spin, the nuclear magnetic moment is so small. If you have fields as small as a tenth of a microgauss, then you'll only have a few degrees of precession after several minutes. Yes. No. You freeze them in the neon matrix, and then you just hit it with a laser pulse to heat it up, and the atom will come off, and you can do your analysis. So I can't hear. I'm sorry.
Are all the stable isotopes in neon
zero? I think that's right. That's a critical point, though. They would have to be. Yes, they are. It's neon 20 and 22, right? I think that's true. But okay. That of course is a critical point. But even then, I think the major problem will be stray fields. That would have to be controlled if you really wanted to store it and fly it across the country, America. But anyway, it's an interesting to look at. And certainly, one can do really relatively long periods of time with that sort of approach. Okay, so then back to the experiment we're talking about. We start. Question?
Yeah.
Yes, it's spin rather than polarization. It's You think I should put that point eight? Okay. Well, okay. The experiment we're talking about is mercury 199 dimers in a spin s equals zero state. This is a nuclear spin zero state. For the mercury, we split them up, and the mercury atoms fly off in opposite directions, in the center of mass, opposite directions. The mercury atom has J equals zero in the ground state. Nuclear spin is a half, so F is equal to I plus J is a half. Okay, and the wave function, the nuclear wave function for these is just exactly the Bohm wave function, two spin one half particles. It's exactly Bohm's EPR experiment, but a real possibility. We use analyzers to determine the components of F in a specific direction, and then we measure correlations between different components of F. Okay. Mercury isotopes. Natural abundance of mercury, this is the percentage of the various ones. We're looking at mercury 199, 16.8%. And if you use a source of natural mercury, you will get both atoms and dimers and multimers and so forth. But among the dimers, 2.84% of them will be the mercury 199 dimers we're interested in. And you don't have to worry about all the others, as you'll see shortly. Spectroscopy separates things out. So the first big problem is you've got the molecule, you got to dissociate it. And what are the complications there, and what can you do? Well, if you look at the energy level diagram for the molecule, this is the ground state. It's a singlet sigma G plus, and this well right here is very, very shallow. It's about 400 degrees K. So it is bound, but small. And this is the first excited state that I'm interested in, and we're going to be interested in the nu equals 60 state. And what we will do is we will drive a transition from the ground state of the molecule up to here at a wavelength of around 266 nanometers. Then we, in a Raman process, we will drive it back down with another laser at 355, which drives it down to an auto-dissociating state of the ground state. So it brings you down to this level right here, and the two atoms fly apart. In the center of mass, they fly apart in exactly opposite directions. In the laboratory, of course, you have, we're doing it with a beam. And so you have the translational velocity of the beam, which is added on, and so actually the two mercury atoms come out in the forward direction. Well, I'm sorry, actually they come out in the distribution, but we're going to pick out ones that go in the forward direction. The point is, if you know where one of them is, you know exactly where the other one is. Okay, so we require it in a nuclear spin singlet state. They're two spin one half particles, so it can be a triplet or a singlet, right? And so we have to look at that. Mercury has total spin one half. It's a fermion. And then, hence by the Pauli principle, if P is the particle exchange operator, then P psi has to equal minus psi by the Pauli principle. Okay? In other words, you interchange the particles, the wave function has to change sign since they're fermions. Well, you can break up particle exchange operator into two operators on the wave, on the electronic wave function. The vibrational wave function, of course, is going to be symmetric automatically. Rotational wave function, and then the nuclear wave function. The ground state is this, and the G implies reflection symmetry, so that the sigma EL up here is plus one. Right there it is. And the plus sign here implies inversion symmetry of the electron wave function. So that's also plus. So this term right here is always plus. The rotational wave function depends on the spherical harmonics. If you change theta by 180 degrees or by pi in the spherical harmonics, they change sign. Okay? And so the rotational wave function goes like minus 1 to j, where j is the total angular momentum of the molecule, times psi rotational, okay? And so you combine all those things, and we get the particle exchange operator operating on the wave function psi, gives you minus 1 to the j times the p nuclear for the nuclear part times the wave function. And what happens now is we have to satisfy this condition that p psi equals minus psi. So this quantity right here, minus 1 to the j times p nuclear, has to be minus 1. Well, in the nuclear spin singlet state, this is what psi looks like. And so clearly, p nuclear is minus 1. You interchange the particle signs, particle numbers there, and you get minus 1, right? So in the singlet state, p nuclear is minus 1. So consequently, if we want this whole thing up here, if that whole factor right there is supposed to be minus 1, p nuclear is already minus 1. That means j has to be plus 1, or has to be even. Okay? So whenever j is an even number, we know we have a nuclear spin singlet state. Okay? And just to sort of complete that argument, for the triplet state, the triplet state consists of all these. And of course, if you interchange operators there, p nuclear is plus 1. So that means j has to be odd in the spin triplets. And so that's how we distinguish between a nuclear spin singlet and a nuclear spin triplet. We simply look, choose atom or molecules with j an even number. Now, in practice, actually, we're choosing j equals 10 because we're using a supersonic jet source, and rotational temperature is about 4 degrees K coming out of the supersonic jet source. You do the Boltzmann distribution, and you get a maximum population in j equals 10. Also, what happens is you also suffer from the fact that there's 3 times as many molecules in the triplet state as in the singlet state, but that's okay, too. There's plenty of signal here. So one of the questions is, I've clearly stated that in the ground state here, if you're in an even J, then you're in a nuclear spin singlet. Okay, but what about after you do this Raman transition? Well, one of the things we rely on is the fact that each leg of this Raman process, the selection rule, since it's a homonuclear molecule, the selection rule is that delta J equals plus or minus 1. Delta J equals 0 is forbidden for a homonuclear molecule. Okay? And so consequently, in this process right here, delta J for the whole process is going to be 0 plus or minus 2. So when you end up here, you're still in a nuclear spin singlet state. So in other words, the Raman process doesn't screw up your choice of the singlet state. You're still dissociating a nuclear spin singlet state here. Okay, so this is a transition we're talking about. We're actually going to go to nu equals 60 in that excited state because that's, let's see, actually, let me go back. What happens, you see, here's the minimum in the well, and so you get nu equals 60 is one of the places where you get maximum transfer of the population. And so this is a simulation of what you get. Now, of course, what happens is the mercury dimers have lots of possibilities there. And one of the possibilities, well, you got 199, 199, that's a total mass of 398. Okay? And it turns out the different masses have pretty significantly different frequencies for the transition. The only one that's close to 199 is 198-200. And those are the transitions in 198-200. This is simulated assuming a line width of 50 megahertz on the laser. And what happens, we're going to p equals 10. And so you can see these separations are significant. This is almost a gigahertz here. Okay. So clearly, for example, you can separate j equals 10 in the ground state from j equals 11 or 9. This is simulated, and we haven't reproduced this yet because we have a laser that has the line width we need. Actually, it has 8 megahertz line width, but we haven't been successful in being able to continuously tune it, and so we still have some work to go. But to get some data on what this looked like, we actually used a laser with a line width of 2 gigahertz, and this is what the spectra looks like. For the 398, this is the two 199s, and these are different combinations, and actually we can simulate this with our estimated line width, and we've actually already gotten rotational and vibrational constants about 1 to 2 orders of magnitude better than anybody had ever had before. But clearly, once you have your line width down, you can separate things. And clearly just dissociate mercury 199 dimers in a nuclear spin singlet state. And any other dimers that are around are way off resonance. Any other nuclear spin triplets are way off resonance. Everything is clean. Okay, so how does it physically look like? Well, this is the way the arrangement would be. You would have a beam of mercury dimers from a supersonic jet coming along here. We will have a dimer excitation laser beam at 266 nanometers that comes in making a small angle, and a dimer dissociating beam at 355 nanometers coming in at right angles. And I need to make another comment here. One of the reasons for having this one almost dimers is when you're dissociating them, you really want to know for sure where the two atoms are. And the supersonic jet has a distribution in longitudinal velocities. And we can significantly improve the ability to determine exactly where they are by taking a narrow slice out of that velocity distribution. And so one of the things we're doing is the idea is to send this laser beam in at 266 nanometers as close to parallel as possible so you can do some velocity discrimination. And that's one of the reasons why we have a much narrower line width on that laser than you really need to separate the spin triplets and singlets. The dissociation lasers that are required, we have the laser that's tunable from 263 to 269 nanometers. This is the first step up. It's an alexandrite laser. It has 150 nanosecond full width half maximum pulses. Was there a question? Okay. It has 4 megahertz line width. I'm sorry, it's supposed to have 4 megahertz line width. We've only gotten 8. And it produces about 40 millijoules in the fundamental. And to achieve this, we've developed a high voltage ramp Q-switch combination that cancels the chirp in the laser. When you get a pulse that long, the length of the cavity starts changing during the pulse, and so we had to cancel that out. The normal line width of that laser is about 50 megahertz. The 355 nanometer system is a trivial one. It's just an excimer pump dye laser. It has 15 nanosecond full width half maximum, 60 gigahertz line width. Doesn't matter what the line width is so much on. The only effect of the line width on the dissociating laser is what the distribution in velocities is of the dissociating molecule, the two atoms from the dissociating molecule, and that's not particularly important at this level. The much more crucial factor is the distribution in velocities of the molecules coming out of the source. So now we know how to do the dimers and separate them. We've already made quite a bit of progress on that. Next question is how you detect them. So we have excitation and ionization. And the process is as follows. You start in the ground state, F equals a half. We hit them with 253 nanometer radiation that takes them up to the triplet P1 state. And then we drive them with a second transition up to this state that's embedded in the continuum. It's a 6P squared triplet P0 state. It has a line width 270 gigahertz, which means the cross section is about 10 to minus 14 square centimeters. That's huge. And it breaks up into an ion and electron in about 3.7 picoseconds. And it only takes about 100 microjoules to actually saturate that transition. So we hit them first with this, and then with this, and you excite and then ionize the mercury atoms. Okay? Oops. So this is what the arrangement looks like. We originally had our mercury dimers here that were dissociated. One atom comes off this way, one atom comes off this way. We then send in an analyzing laser beam at 253.7 nanometers. That's that resonant transition. That's this transition right here, 253.7. And we also send in an ionizing laser beam at 197.3. That was the second transition. And you get an ion, an electron coming out. There was the data I just described for you. So the thing decays very, very quickly. What you can do is you can calculate, you can solve the whole equation to see how things work there. And in particular, one of the reasons we're particularly looking at this is, I don't know whether you might have heard of the counterintuitive scheme, but one of the ways, if you want to transfer a population from one level in an atom to another level in an atom, is you can actually fire the second laser first, and it builds up a coherence. So in fact, actually, you can transfer all the population from one state to another. And the question is, that's basically what we want to do, but it doesn't really work in this case because of the short lifetime of that state in the continuum up there. But nonetheless, we did the calculations, and it turns out you basically get 100% ionization with about a 2 nanosecond delay. In other words, the second pulse should follow the first pulse by about 2 nanoseconds, okay, to get complete ionization. The excitation ionization lasers is actually one laser. And that's critically important because if you know anything about lasers, you know trying to synchronize two lasers to within a couple nanoseconds is very difficult, particularly if they're at different wavelengths. So actually what we do is we have a single laser that produces 253 is the third harmonic of 761, and 197 is the fourth harmonic of 789. So these two fundamental wavelengths are produced simultaneously in a flash lamp pump tie sapphire laser, which I should maybe call laser system because actually it's an amplifier rather than a laser, but okay. And I'm kind of proud of this laser. I think it's fairly unique, but basically we start out with two external cavity diode lasers. We send them in to, this is the main tie sapphire laser. We send them in and you fire the Q switch and the light that's already in here gets trapped and bounces back and forth about 32 times. Then we fire the Q switch again and all the light comes out. There's a secondary output here that's small too, but here's the light coming out. And what this does for you is you get both wavelengths simultaneously, and they're both completely independently tunable to any frequency you want, okay? And they're narrow line width, single frequency narrow line width. I think it's maybe unique in that regard, but okay. So then, how about the detection? Well, okay, here's the plane of the lasers. Here's the mercury atoms coming in. Now there's one of these on each arm to detect the atoms. And you produce both an ion and an electron here. We have basically an electrostatic lens here to focus the ions and accelerate them. They're accelerated to about 25 kilovolts, and they slam into a metal plate with an aluminum coating on it at a fairly small angle. That by making that angle small, you actually increase the number of electrons that come off. And so when that ion hits, you actually knock 10 or 15 electrons off. And then your channeltron can detect them, and you detect every one. And basically, we haven't been able to do a coincidence measurement yet to verify that we've got 100%. But by looking at saturation things, we basically have 100% detection efficiency on the ions. At the same time, you get an electron, and this would be a nice extra measurement to actually measure the electrons over here. Unfortunately, we've had some trouble there. The thing is, with electrons and UV light around, there's lots of stray electrons, and we have the backgrounds are just too big here. Backgrounds are about 10 times the signal is the best we've been able to do, and it needs to be about 1,000 times smaller. And so I'm not sure whether we're ever going to solve that problem with electrons or not. It would be nice to be able to get the electrons because then you'd have two independent measurements on that channel. Okay, so now, nuclear spin analysis. how you determine what the spin is. You can't use steering gear lock apparatus. It just, you can't rotate them fast, and the nuclear spin of Mercury 199 is so small you couldn't resolve the spots. The magnetic moment of Mercury 199. But what we do is we take advantage of the hyperfine structure. And so what happens is you have two levels down here. This is F equals a half in the ground state of the mercury atom. Okay? So that means it has an M sub F equals minus a half and plus a half. In the excited state up here, the triplet P1 state, I is still a half, but J is 1 up here, so you can have F equals 3 halves and 1 half. Those are separated by 22 gigahertz, so once again, they're well resolved. What we do is we just go to the F equals 1 half state when we do this excitation. Before, I just told you it was an excitation, but now you're going to learn a little more about it. The 253.7 is right circularly polarized, for example. It could be left, but as an example, suppose it's right circularly polarized. If it's right circularly polarized, the selection rule is delta M sub F equals plus 1. Okay? That means if I shine this light on, M sub F equals minus a half here can be excited, but M sub F equals plus a half has nowhere to go. So we can selectively excite only atoms with M sub F equals minus a half. Well, what does that mean? Of course, J is 0, so that's really the component of the nuclear spin is minus a half. But minus a half in what direction? Well, what happens is whenever you draw a diagram like this, you always have to have a quantum axis in mind. And in this case, this is right circularly polarized light, and it is only right circularly polarized for one well-defined direction in space, the direction of propagation. Okay? So consequently, the direction of propagation determines the direction in which you're measuring the component of nuclear spin. Okay? And so what happens is we excite with right circularly polarized light, and if the atom is in a nuclear spin, MF equals minus a half, it will be excited and then come on up and ionize, and we detect it. Okay? If it's plus a half, nothing happens. Okay? So we have nuclear spin analysis. Actually, there's two possibilities here, because this triplet P0 state in the continuum up here has M sub F equals minus a half and plus a half. And so depending on polarizations of the 197, you can go one route or the other. And here you see them. This is the ionizing laser beam coming in here, and the analyzing laser beam comes in at an angle. This is for case one I showed on the previous one. If the ionizing laser beam comes in here, it's case two. But basically, your analyzing beam comes in here at some angle theta I, and this is the direction which you're measuring nuclear spin components, the direction of this first laser beam. Quantum mechanical predictions. This is all straightforward stuff. The Strong-Bell inequality, this is from Clauser and Shimony paper, and that's what we have is this case. Because what happens is we have perfect detection efficiency, so we don't have that problem. What you find, so all this stuff right here has to be less than or equal to 1. If you choose this set of optimum angles, the left-hand side is 1.207 eta g, and I didn't tell you what eta and g were. Okay, eta is the detection efficiency. And G is the probability that if you detect the first atom, that you detect the second one. Okay, so the G only comes in the correlation thing. And you can't absolutely guarantee that if you detect the first one, you're going to detect the second one, because there's some distributions. The velocity distribution in the initial beam, and so it smears things out a little bit. So we have to include that, too. So that G right there is the correlation factor. And so when you put all those in, you find the left-hand side is 1.207 A to G, which means A to G is greater than 1. Has to be, in order to test the Bell inequalities, A to G has to be greater than 0.828. And in our experiment, I put eight is greater than 0.98, but actually I think it's 1. And G, we've calculated based on simple geometry, and we get G equals 0.97. So that means A to G is 0.95, so we should have a really good test. What about enforcing locality? As I pointed out, the component of the spin you measure is determined by the direction of propagation of the right circular polarized laser beam. And so you can already see that's easy to change and change fast, right? Suppose we have the beam coming in here. Here's our mercury atom right there. And the laser beam comes through at some angle A, for example. And you measure spin components along this direction then. But suppose you want to switch it to some other direction. What you can do is you can put a Pockel cell right here and a polarizer. And then if you fire the Pockel cell, the light is reflected by the polarizer and comes in from this direction. If you don't fire the Pockel cell, it just goes straight through. And so you can, and something I left out here, of course, they have to be right circular polarized. So after the polarizer, you have to put a wave plate too. But okay, that's a detail. But you can see, you can fire the Pockel cell in a nanosecond. So in principle, you can actually change the direction you measure nuclear spin components in times of the order of a couple nanoseconds. That's it.
What is the difference
between 100%. Now, I haven't proven that by doing a correlation measurement yet, but we base that on looking at saturation effects. In other words, if you start changing the laser intensity and you measure the number of ions you get, it comes up and it flattens off. And so I'm pretty sure it's 100%. But it will take a correlation measurement to prove that absolutely. Are you surprised or you're... Well, the point is what happens is when that ion hits that aluminum plate, it sprays out a bunch of electrons. And so even if your detection efficiency for an electron is only 90%, you get a pulse every time, or almost every time to within infinitesimal amounts. No. I did not. Let's see. What I did say was the second laser follows the first laser by 2 nanoseconds to optimize the ionization. So yeah, I guess you would say 2 nanoseconds. That's true. Yes. Oh, for the ion goes very, very fast because it's accelerated to 25 kilovolts, and it's a short distance. I don't know what the time is, but and actually what happens is in our initial experiments, we aren't going to close the locality loophole. That is something that will come later in which we'll actually move the detectors further apart. And then, of course, what happens is we also have this thing in the back of our minds about storing the two components of the entangled state, which I think is sort of a mind-boggling idea that you can store two components of an entangled state and carry them off to different places. Can't store them that long. On time scales of a millisecond, it's a nuclear magnetic moment. And so it's very, very small. And just reducing fields to a few tenths of a Gauss is enough to eliminate all problems. Now, if you want to start talking about storing them for a minute, then that's when fields have to become a real problem. That's the advantage of the nuclear magnetic moment. It's so small. Nothing affects it. Angular resolution of, you mean of the direction I'm measuring?
Yeah, in other words, you have to measure
it's going to be the divergence of my laser beam, which is going to be a few milliradians. So that's small. Well, actually, that's a long story. When I first talked to you, probably in the 80s about this, when I first talked to you, perhaps in the 80s, I don't remember, I was talking about doing hydrogen and doing a hydrogen molecule and electron spin, which isn't nearly as nice, and didn't have the lasers and so forth. And I had a postdoc working with me, and I asked him to look at this problem with hydrogen with me and do some calculations. And that was Sifong Li, who's on that paper that we published about this experiment. And he came back to me within 24 hours and said, Dr. Fry says, why do you want to use hydrogen? Use silver, because silver you can do everything right away. And I didn't like the idea of silver because I was sort of imbued with the idea of everything should be hydrogen. It's such a simple atom and molecule. But 24 hours later, I decided that he was right, and so we actually did all the calculations for silver. And now this is an electron magnetic moment in silver. We ran into trouble in the dissociation process, and I thought it was all kaput at that point, and I actually went through the periodic table. The key point is, to get dissociation of a molecule with reasonable laser energies, you need to have an excited state whose minimum is shifted with respect to the minimum of the ground state. And I looked at a lot of systems to find that. And mercury stepped out as a really good one. And there's a few others like that. Ytterbium will also work, I believe. And but mercury just sort of jumped out when I was looking for these things. And the fact there's a nuclear spin is just perfect. Yeah. The analyzers are two channels. Yeah, you have to have an analyzer at each. Is that what you meant? Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, yes. We only measure one. Our plan right now is to only measure one. Now, in principle, what happens, we could follow that up with another laser beam, less circularly polarized, and play the same game again and double all the experiment. But so in principle, you could do that, because if for example you have right circularly polarized light, the m sub f equals minus a half state will be excited and detected. The m sub f equals plus a half state will keep right on going straight ahead. So you could go another foot down the apparatus and shine a left circularly polarized beam in and detect it. With the ion system, in the detection of the ion, there are no backgrounds. We did a lot of work to clean that up, but we basically had no backgrounds in the ions, just the dark noise of the detector. And the dark noise of the detector becomes negligible when you're looking at just a narrow time frame. It's a channeltron detector. And channeltrons have dark noise of maybe a count per second or something like that. But then when you only look over periods of a microsecond, it becomes almost irrelevant. The electrons, big backgrounds, and I'm not sure we'll ever solve the problem with electrons. And it would be nice, because then you would have both an electron and an ion if you could do that. Well, Danny, I got other, number one, I don't have money for it right now, and number two, as I told you, I'm department head right now, and it has wiped me out. I ask Shinmei how often I've been in the lab recently. So I don't know. I'm going to be done with department head in 2 years, and then I'm going to put a lot of effort into trying to make this, bring it to completion. Right. I can't imagine ever retiring. Yeah, I understand. You told me you retired last month, but then several of my colleagues have told me you retired 3 years ago. No, well.